engaged in with political parties. It's an exciting period. To keep touch with the electorate. But I hope in the middle of all that, we still had time to rest. And therefore, this is our first meeting, and I hope we are all fresh, and we're starting with one of the most important pieces of legislation in front of us. We started the process last year, and we decided that we follow a particular process so that we can give affected parties sufficient time to consult with and for them to make good presentations before the committee can make a determination on how we should move forward. We've got a number of about seven presentations today from different stakeholders. I would want to take this opportunity once more on your side to welcome all of you. It is quite exciting to see you in such numbers in our first meeting. It also says to us, you really take the work of Parliament very seriously. You also take your inputs as part and parcel of legislation making in South Africa. But more than anything else, that participatory democracy must be alive. And I think we are very, very much grateful on that score. As I have indicated, we have got the South African Oil and Gas Alliance. They'll give us a presentation. They'll be followed by South African Institute for Chartered Accountants. And then we'll take Global Maritime Learning Solutions. Then we'll have discussions before we take other presentations. Unfortunately, because of time constraints, you'd probably have been told or the program does indicate how much time we have for your presentation. For the staff that always supports ourselves in Parliament, you are also welcomed. I see the content advisor, the researcher, Ellen, good to have you again. You are a permanent part of our committee. Thank you very much. Is the SADGA SAUGA, ready? Okay. You'll introduce yourself and your team. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairman. My name is Ibrahim. I am the Chief Executive of the South African Oil and Gas Alliance, and I will. We will also be represented by Mr. Jean Poole, who advises us on customs issues. I will introduce the South African Oil and Gas Alliance and then hand over to Jean to talk about the detail, and then Jean will take questions if there are any. The South African Oil and Gas Alliance represents the upstream and midstream sectors of the oil and gas value chain in South Africa. So we have quite a few industry players in that sector, from engineering firms to ship and rig repair firms to companies that are active in the offshore and onshore exploration, and companies that are also looking at the logistics side of oil and gas. The industry has changed significantly in the past few years, and there's quite a bit of activity expected in South Africa and also regionally in Africa, which has seen us come up with some very interesting questions related to customs. And the issue that John will be elaborating on today is one of the most pressing issues that affect the oil and gas industry, and I'll hand over to Jean.
Thank you, Ibrahim. Good morning, everyone. Okay, so the committee will find three pieces of paper in front of you. And the first is the comment sheet, which is basically the submission from the South African Oil and Gas Alliance. In that particular form, you'll find a proposed amendment to the Customs Control Bill, being subsection 2 of section 90. Then the second piece of paper you'll find is a letter issued by the Durban Customs Office in 2009, which sets out the current temporary import procedure which must be followed at all customs offices in South Africa, which is basically a manual procedure. And then the first piece of paper that you'll find is an email which I jotted off last night to SARS, my colleagues at SARS, just giving a bit of background and explaining in more detail what the problem is, as well as the possible alternatives. So essentially, if you look at the second piece of paper, the letter from SARS Customs in Durban, you'll see there's a highlighted paragraph which sets out, and clients are required to obtain prior approval before processing any clearances from the local customs office. And if head office approval is required, local office will make the submission to head office for approval on behalf of the client. So nowadays, because thanks to customs modernization, there is a generally customs declarations are submitted electronically in South Africa to SARS. And the turnaround time is approximately, I would say, it ranges from a few minutes to a few hours in order to get release of your goods, unless they are stopped or queried for supporting documents. So, but this procedure, which is a manual process, requires that you must first submit a letter on behalf of a trader to customs, and manually submit it to customs, and deliver it to customs, together with an undertaking and supporting documents, including literature, applying for permission to clear goods electronically under specific general rebate items of the customs tariff. Then, following your submission, the turnaround time is approximately 7 days, I think, on average. It can vary, of course, it can be a little less or a little more. And customs basically responds by letter and granting you permission. And then with that permission letter in hand, you are then permitted to basically upload your customs declaration electronically into the electronic data interchange gateway to SARS. And once SARS receives it, SARS will then call for supporting documents, including the permission letter from customs. So normally this manual application process with customs also entails an amount of security which must be lodged. Security is basically a potential duty and VAT, or at least a nominal payment, which is basically designed to make you, the trader, comply with certain obligations. For example, to export the goods within a specified period, and then to apply to customs for liquidation of your provisional payment. Okay, so with that background, in the email that I sent to SARS yesterday, which is the third attachment, I said to SARS that an alternative to the current proposal to the committee, which is basically an alternative to the current proposal is simply for SARS to allow the customs declaration, which one has to submit electronically to customs, to be the application for temporary import. Then, if SARS then queries that for supporting documents, you could submit, you could upload your letter electronically to customs, together with an undertaking and all the other supporting documents, and then SARS can make a call as to the amount of insecurity. But obviously, I have to address the whole issue in terms of current practices at SARS. So, we'd be very happy to engage with SARS, and we would prefer it, of course, if the entire process could be automated. But if that is not possible, then we would like the committee to consider this proposed amendment, which is set out in the first attachment, the comment sheet. which is basically, I'll read it out to you, and 690 reads, for the purpose of clearing imported goods that are in terms of section 89 required to be cleared for home use or a customs procedure, a clearance declaration meeting the requirements of sections 171A to D must, subject to subsection 2 and 3, be submitted to the customs authority if the goods were imported on board a foreign-going vessel within 3 working days of arrival of the goods at the customs seaport, where the goods are to be offloaded from the vessel. In B, if the goods were imported on board a foreign-going aircraft within 3 working days of arrival as well, then our proposed amendment, which is insert new subsection 2, provided that where the submission of the declaration is preceded by a manual application to the customs authority involving the lodgement of security, the submission of the declaration shall be deemed to be the time when the manual application is received by the customs authority. Provided further with respect to subsection 2 that the applicant must file a standard clearance declaration within 3 working days from the date on which the customs authority communicates the approval of the application to the applicant. Thank you very much. That's it from us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. As I've indicated in the beginning, that will take the we'll enter into the discussions once we've received 3 submissions. Can we go to SAICA?
Good morning, honourable members and other participants. My name is Arthur Poulos. I represent SAICA Subcommittee on Customs and Excise. A little bit of an introduction. The committee itself is comprised of a number of members from a variety of firms, not necessarily just chartered accountants, but those seated in legal positions, those with a combined experience, I'm sure running into the decades, and including people that have worked in SARS, customs clearing, forwarding and shipping, consulting environments, and the legal sphere, as well as audits and similar. The slides will come up in a moment. Before they do, I'd like to indicate that our approach to the bills and our purpose here today is to indicate that we are not opposed to the bills coming out. I think it's long-awaited and there's been a lot of hard work put into drafting them. But certainly we're not happy to support the bills in the state as they were submitted to the National Assembly on 24 October 2013. Now, if we go to the first slide, please. The next one. I just put through an overview of the timeline of the interaction between SAICA and, as it happens, SARS and the comment process on the new bills. As you can see, all the way back in 2010 was the first round of comments that we submitted. We had quite a fruitful interaction with SARS. We had quite a bit of time afforded to us, and I think both parties engaged in that process and saw a lot of benefit from it. However, as you see, there was a little bit of a dry spell, and I would imagine it's in no small part due to the voluminous nature of the act. Proposed bills and the attention required and the number of changes were made. And, we see again a second round of comments that were offered by SARS, and I should just point out, those are the days that we submitted our comments. We were in those cases given a period of about 1 to 2 weeks in which to submit those comments, so a significantly shorter opportunity for interaction. In fact, there was no interaction whatsoever, simply just submission of the written comments. And of course, I'm sure you've all seen the timeline stretching out right till 2013, and in fact now the beginning of 2014 where we sit together. That gap in the middle indicates that there was no further interaction. Some of our members might have individually interacted with SARS during that period, but there was, in respect of our comments and the requests for information, there were a couple of gaps that we'd obviously be more comfortable if we had a bit of clarity on. the combined experience of our members and our general approach tends to avoid the clearing and shipping detail, those interactions that tends to be dealt with by a lot of the members working in the clearing and forwarding industry. They're concerned with those transactions on a day-to-day basis. We have the experience in that field, but we tend to focus on the legal and policy elements. And, of course, our primary objective is to avoid as many unintended consequences that the bills might pose when they're, in fact, enacted. I'll be honest, we detest struggling as much as SARS or any other client does. And I think, you know, we enjoy having good, strong arguments with all role players in the industry, but ultimately it must be on the basis of a sound legislation. You know, there are one or two colleagues, I won't mention, of course, are the legal sphere, that often when we are bantering things around, we'll often reference it to, well, what on earth are you guys going on about? You know, let's just let it work its way out in the courts. As, you know, as a rule, we're generally against that. We'd like to make sure that whatever SARS lands up being handed to run with is as sound and as strong a structure foundation as possible. So, a fundamental comment, and I'll get on to one or two specifics in the next couple of slides, but one of the fundamental elements that we've been requesting and we've been waiting for is the subsidiary legislation. Now, if you look at the old legislation, Act of 1964, the subsidiary part is voluminous. It's massive. You've got all the tariffs that's sitting there, you've got a number of agreements, you've got the rules to the Act, and that on a day-to-day basis gives us a lot of meat to work with, and it gives clients the detail that they need in order to function effectively. I'm sure you've all had sights of the bills proposed, but I should mention to you that as voluminous as they seem, there's still more on its way. The difficulty we have is that in order to really contribute in a way that's meaningful, while we have a view on a number of the provisions that have been created in the current bills, there's still a lot of detail missing. And ultimately, to be holistic in our approach and to bring across the comments that will ultimately benefit all parties, we really need to have sight of it. I don't think that, you know, while there's still meaningful comment that can be made in the bills as they exist, I think ultimately we would feel more comfortable if we knew what was coming in the rules and regulations as referenced in the Act. I really don't think we can allow that to come out at the last minute when the bills are enacted. We really need to have sight of that in advance. And I'm going to emphasize it a third time. We really, really would like to see the rules and regulations. It's important. Customs, unlike certain other disciplines, while there might be certain items that remain in the air and open to interpretation, what I've always found encouraging is that if you ever wanted to find the answer, as convoluted as some of the past legislation may have been, you ultimately can find it written down. If you work through it, and you research it and you prepare yourself, you will find the answers. We just want to make sure that putting our minds to the test here, that we are finding those answers and finding those unintended consequences before they become difficult for us, clients, and SARS to manage on the ground day to day. We submitted a number of comments, and the response from SARS has been good in this regard. I think they've seen the value fresh pair of eyes taking a look at the documentation. A number of the comments that we made did result in amendments and changes to the bills. Everything from basic typographical errors through to consistency issues and even some interpretive matters. However, there are a couple of fundamentals that have not changed, and it concerns me because these are items we've identified from the first round of comments right through to the second round. And from the draft or the final draft that I've had sight of that has been forwarded to the National Assembly, they seem to remain in place. I'm not sure if perhaps through other forums these have been attended to, so excuse me if there have been subtle amendments or changes, but I will address them here. There are a number of other technical matters which we would like addressed too, but I think in the context of this forum it would be more prudent to deal with those items that are more clearly understood. Technical matters can get a bit tedious, and if our comments have not been heard to date, then I guess the burden will remain on the client and SARS at the operational level to deal with them once these bills are enacted. So we'll just focus on a couple of the important ones. In respect of the customs control bill, we have a reference to the period of validity of registration certificates being limited to 3 years. I should inform you that there was no such limitation in the past, and we need to distinguish between registration and licensing. Those are two different processes. But insofar as registration is concerned, the very basic level of interaction with SARS begins at the registration. Whatever you do, you have to be registered. Unless, of course, you're doing something illegal, in which case you'll just run across the border with it. And then there's no registration required whatsoever. But ultimately, how you perform, how you interact, and how SARS conducts a relationship with you will be based on what you're registered for. It's the building block on which you base the rest of your transactions. You want to import, you need to be registered. Export, similarly. You've got excise activities, rebate provisions, whatever it may be. This is where you're telling SARS, this is my intention, this is how I intend to conduct myself. And SARS will always measure you against that. So what's the big fuss? Why should we concern ourselves if we're updating these or changing these or suspending these every 3 years? Well, the problem is it hasn't been done before. Okay, and the difficulty is that one of the central tenets of this, of the new bills, is that they're in alignment with the modernization program, and one of the fundamentals there is that we need to facilitate trade. If you go and you make every single registrant or client re-register every 3 years, you are creating an administrative nightmare. You don't have to believe me. There's already been a case in point. Head office, from the office of Mr. Bates Ron, at one point, sent out carte blanche a number of notices to clients. Fast, email, just blanket, got a gunshot approach, and requesting them to resubmit their registrations or re-register their activities. And this sent all of these clients into an absolute tailspin. And I don't believe that head office, while I did not sit in that office, I don't believe that they could cope with the applications that they were inundated with. Currently, the burden is manageable. New clients will submit applications or amendments. They will typically, if they have all their documentation in alignment, get a registration within 5 to 10 working days, which I think is acceptable. Of course, gathering that information can be quite a burden, but SARS has made significant strides over the last decade in updating their registration database. 10 years ago, I can say to you, any clearing agent or any individual could have walked in with a DA-185, which is the registration document, submitted it to SARS, and probably within the same day or same week got a registration without any supporting documentation, just simply filling in the form. 10 years later, the branch offices have verification offices. They are scrutinizing those applications. They're looking for supporting documentation, directors' identity documents, certificates of incorporation, and a whole string of documentation to make sure that they know who their client is. The problem is, I can understand that over time, especially with companies, the company entities, you know, things do change, and the people that you would hold liable might very well come and go. But the onus there is on the client to make sure that is updated. The real problem is, if you just apply this as we simply read it, you need to consider that it will automatically create a problem. If a client suddenly finds their activity suspended or halted, it will create a trade facilitation nightmare. And I believe that the infrastructure and the resources that SARS has on their disposal to continuously review and update clients' registrations is not available. So I understand the intention is a good intention. The mechanism is unacceptable. And I don't think you can allow this to go through. I believe you cannot allow this to go through. The status quo should remain. The systems that SARS is developing are updating and being updated and improving all the time, the procedures. SARS needs to find comfort in that and rely on that. You cannot put in a general provision requiring that everybody re-register every 3 years. The customs duty bill. There's two elements here that we'd like to look at. The time limit or prescription on duty reassessments increased to 3 years. If I can explain it very simply, if SARS were to review or audit you they would typically identify an element or an item that they would like to focus on, and if there's any contravention, they would go and schedule you based on 2 years worth of transactions. They might very well do more, but the prescription is 2 years if you bring it back to the basics. SARS can at any time go further than that if they can prove that there's misrepresentation, fraud, or any other attempt to evade the duties. Why this has been increased to 3 years is not clear to us. I can find a number of excuses for it, but the thing is that I don't understand why, if it is so important that this be increased to 3 years, why on earth we are waited this long, or rather waited for the new bills in which to do it. It just doesn't seem right to us. I can think of a lot of other creative reasons for it. This is revenue generation. And we're getting close to, maybe I don't mean to be too facetious, but we are getting close to the end of the SARS financial year. Typically this is a time when schedules flow, as it helps build the targets that SARS needs to reach for revenue generation. This is an automatic add an extra 50% onto that schedule. Because whatever basis that you determined that there was a contravention on, as long as it was for the applicable period, you can simply go back and find enough transactions for an extra year, and thank you very much, you've got extra revenue. So it may be that I can find a number of other reasons why this provision is included, but I just don't understand why, if it is so important to include it, and it's so fundamental, anybody can understand this, why on earth we waited for the bills? Why didn't we do it a couple of years ago? I think the status quo is sufficient. If we're led to believe that the modernization program will make SARS systems more efficient and the focus will come to post-clearance inspection, in other words, audits after importation, then SARS has already committed the resources to ensure that any duties that have been left astray will be collected. They don't need the extra time. 2 years is sufficient. Our recommendation is that the status quo remain, unless, of course, there's a particular motivation that we've not covered. Validity period of advanced rulings, limited to 3 years unless otherwise stipulated. Advanced rulings were often referred to, is the current term proposed in the bills. They were referred to as rulings or determinations in the past. And these come back to the three pillars of customs clearance. You need to determine the value of the goods, as many articles work on an ad valorem duty. Even if the duty rate is zero, it's still a duty. But even on goods which attract a specific duty, the value is critical because it forms the basis for the calculation of importation of import VAT. The origin of the goods is very important for a number of reasons, including determining whether or not goods qualify for preferential treatment, and especially in respect of agreements that we have with our trading partners. And lastly, the classification of the goods. What are we talking about? How on earth do we know what duty to levy? Where in our system, a very methodical, very clear system, do we put the goods in order to determine what the liability for them is? So what typically would have happened in the past, if there's any reason to doubt the value, the origin, or the tariff classification, this would typically be referred to SARS, or SARS might raise the query. Clients could also apply for a ruling in advance of the goods being arriving if there was any doubt in their mind. Typically, the system that we employ, and I'm sure you would have seen it, and this is one of the good things about the new bills, it makes it quite explicit. Clients rely on self-assessment. In other words, they must determine at the time of importation, when they clear the goods, how they see them being treated. And of course, it's always open to inspection or audit after the fact. The difficulty here is that in the past, rulings were left indefinitely. Yes, they might have been withdrawn. They could possibly, the law might have changed, and so the rulings themselves might no longer have been applicable, but they remained. What we've got to understand here is that any of those three pillars require an intense technical knowledge to fully and correctly apply. SARS has made great improvements, particularly if I look within the valuation sphere at head office level, because often applications do land up there. You know, they've managed to get applications down for a couple of months in terms of approving rulings, whereas previously they could easily have extended beyond a year. But what we've got to recognize is that if you make people go back and resubmit all of their applications, you're going to land up with an administrative nightmare once again. There's no reason, unless something fundamental changed, and then always the onus was on the client to make sure that they approached the SARS and to be wary of it. There's no reason, if there's any other fundamental reason, any other fundamental from the client or in terms of the way that the law views the ruling, for it to change. We do not understand why it should be renewed every 3 years. This is the wrong mechanism to control and ensure compliance. There's one other little subtle detail at the end of that clause which I keep picking up. It's a three-letter word called fee. Now, I can understand that in certain applications, for example, the tariff application, when you classify a good, that there might be fees payable if SARS or the client needed to engage the services of a third party, for example, the SABS or any other institution that needed to test a sample or to analyze literature or present literature. That I can understand. But in the absence of the rules and regulations and any other indication that we immediately see, we do not understand why a fee should be payable. As we read it, as it's presented, it indicates that whether you apply for valuation, classification, or origin ruling, you will have to pay a fee. As far as I know, there's not been applicable in the past, and I do not understand how it can be allowed in the future. My quick reaction is to call it cash for compliance. I'm going to coin the phrase. That cannot be allowed. Especially since in cases where clients intend to ensure that they are in line with the rule of the law, that they should be accommodated and they should have compliance freely available to them. And in other circumstances, which is the majority of circumstances, where SARS queries a matter, it is not in any way clear to me how on earth the client can be expected to pay for that, unless, of course, there's a contravention where the penal provisions would apply. This provision cannot be allowed. The status quo should remain. There should be no fee payable except those that would ordinarily be paid by the client in the pursuit of the information required to qualify the application. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for your time. I'd just like to re-emphasize our belief that the rules and regulations as a central point in understanding and evaluating the bills should be made available. It's not our intention to insist that the bills be abandoned. They should go through at some point, but in their current state, we would advise that further discussion be held. I understand that in the second round of comments, SARS indicated that this forum would be the appropriate place to deal with any further comments, although I would like to indicate also that these three comments are fundamental items. We have not brought a number of other technical queries and comments to the table. We would gladly engage and offer our resources further to ensure that these bills avoid as many unintended consequences as possible, because we want to make sure we can work with them as much as any other stakeholder. We're not going to avoid all the problems. But where we can see from our combined experience that there are going to be some stumbling blocks, gosh, I don't see why we can't spend a couple of extra months sorting that out. Because Lord knows it's going to cost someone a lot of money and all of us a lot of time, because when that officer sits at the port and he reads or she reads the act and they need to apply it, if we can see that they are going to have a difficulty or they might very well have to flip a coin, then the duty is on us to make sure that they are given something they can work with. Not assume that everybody that views it understands it or can see the stumbling block at the head office level or similarly in the consulting environment and experienced environment. So the rules and regulations are critical to us. We'd really like to see them, and we would be very happy to see them before these bills are ultimately enacted. To not see them would be going in blind. And if nothing else, and if the paper's right about nothing else tomorrow, these three items should be amended accordingly. Their status quo should be preserved, and these cannot be allowed to be enacted as presented. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Saika, I think we've had your comments and your submissions. They'll form part of the deliberations as we move on, and probably there'll be questions and comments after the next presentation. GMLS, Global Maritime Learning Solutions. Sars, you are here. Sars. Oh, Kosi, I just see you.
We are back in.
Okay. Well, you know, as we complete one year after the other, it also signals that there's growth, and some of us, our eyesight begins to deteriorate. I'm sorry about that. Welcome, Madame.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry for
everybody. My name is Mark Goodger from Global Maritime Legal Solutions. Thank you for the opportunity to address all the dignitaries, SARS members, freight forwarders, and the community today. The opportunity afforded to us is gratefully appreciated. And I'd like to start off with a wise African proverb: if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, let's go together. The question at hand today, without going into giving everybody a lesson on logistics and international supply chain, is the question of provision of a customs declaration concerning goods to be carried to an inland destination. And in that particular regard, our organization, GMLS, were approached after representations and scanning across all the consultants in the market, and the award was eventually given to the University of Cape Town to appoint a consultant to conduct a research into possible impacts of this requirement of customs declaration and its potential impacts. What's important is that to note from the table of contents is that we addressed, out of the 16 issues that were provided, the number 5, the Revised Kyoto Convention, the safe framework of standards, and the impact of proposed customs policy change in contracts of sale and Incoterms, and then Transnet developments and considerations, as well as recommendations. We were requested to provide this report to the University of Cape Town, who in turn made it available to NEDLAC, who in turn made it available to SARS, and in a follow-up we wrote to SARS, never received a response offering our help and insight into our research. We'd also indicated in this report to SARS that we would have loved their participation into the research. Unfortunately, that does not forthcoming. what were the concerns? Our concerns were trade facilitation. Was it taken care of in terms of the revised Kyoto Convention and in the spirit thereof, in particular the WCO Safe Framework of Standards? These two instruments drive modern customs behavior today. As mentioned, despite consultation with SARS and requests to participate, we were unsuccessful. We went ahead after 4 months and conducted the research and particularly focused on incoterms and ports versus terminals, because there is a continued reluctance or fear on the part of SARS to include the word ports or inland ports. Our academic activities reflect quite clearly that inland waterways have become new in terms of training, and customs ports are provided for, the word ports are provided for in many customs instruments and conventions. Then, without any consultation to us, and in the last presentation made before this committee, there was a report produced from Professor Iceland of UNISA, and these were his views. He disagreed with the Chamber of Commerce views that there would be effects to traders, that they would change the terms of their contract of sale. He disagreed that the policy change would result in a change of contract. He disagreed to GMLS interpretation of the International Chamber of Commerce rules. And he disagreed that carriers will, as a result of the policy, change and no longer issue a through bond. He furthermore criticized and used the word generalities and misleading statements. I've never had the pleasure to meet Professor Iceland. However, I'm sorry that he didn't engage with us. Now, we don't mean today to put this committee through a court process of judging whether we or Professor Iceland is correct. However, in turn, we now must make a presentation, and at least we need to provide some credentials before this committee so that you can make your own judgments and conclusions. A key program for the Revised Kyoto Convention for the WCO is, in fact, the Revised Kyoto Convention. And you'll note in this bill that it does provide in the definitions for international instruments, and it goes a long way to embracing the Revised Kyoto Convention. And that was manifested in the SARS slide. The extract from the Revised Kyoto Convention was that the government of the Republic of South Africa accedes to the Protocol of Amendment to the Convention and acceptance of the General Annex. At this point, I wish to put before you that the General Annex has been acceded to, not the specific annex. In the SARS presentation, there were the two slides clearly evidencing non-acceptance or accedance to date by South Africa of the specific annexes, and yet indicating that many of them were incorporated into the legislation. Our concern is then, why not accede to it so that we have then the international reference and the reference back to the WCO in terms of disagreements or interpretations. The Revised Kyoto Convention, in terms of SAC and neighbouring countries in this WCO East and South region, has been accepted by 11 out of 22 in the region. It was established as far back as 1973, amended, and South Africa acceded to it in 2004. Today, 10 years later, we're trying to rush through the legislation. It entered into force in terms of its amendments in 2006 with the 78 contracting parties. But in addition to that, the Safe Framework of Standards was also adopted in 2005, and it was at a time when our current Minister of Finance was the WCO chairperson. The revised Kyoto's preamble is quite clear that it looks to simplify and harmonize customs procedures. It focuses fundamentally in its preamble on facilitation without compromising customs control standards, and looks at modernization, efficiency, predictability in terms of the two annexes sitting and resting with the United Nations. At the heart of the change that we are concerned with is no longer acceptance of the manifest for an entry into an inland port or terminal. This manifest is traditionally lodged with the or by the carrier, as it has been for the last 30 odd years since the introduction of containerization. We look at the spirit of the revised Kyoto Convention from a point of view of mutual recognition and very much have a concern that in terms of the 3 days that SARS wants to implement for pre-customs clearance to allow through manifested cargo to an inland destination, that there's not much cooperation on a mutual cooperation basis with other customs administrations. As mentioned, the international agreements are provided for and described in the definitions. Risk management, however, in Chapter 6.
Chairperson, can I just, I think we've got 10 minutes left of this briefing and I don't want to miss the thrust of it. So you must just bear that in mind, so that if you cut off in 10 minutes and you haven't dealt with what you want to tell us, you know, it's an opportunity missed.
Thank you. I believe I had 20 minutes. Yes, thank you. Okay, you've just taken one. Okay. Okay.
One more point.
Thank you. In terms of Chapter 6, risk management is advocated as the reasons for the new change in policy. And South Africa has a right to a secure trade pipeline. We spend lots of money in terms of investment into Transnet. And Transnet, as we know, has gone on its capacity building programs, showing the spending on trains, on infrastructure going inland, on terminals for containers, and City Deep and Tambo Springs. We are talking as if the vessels should dock in City Deep or in Tambo Springs or any other inland terminal. That is our concern that has been removed. The Safe Framework of Standards, which customs are now responsible for in terms of global supply chain security, is a new responsibility. That standard has, in our opinion, been misinterpreted to prevent customs clearance and transit to inland destination terminals. After the 9/11, this particular Safe Framework was updated 5 times. In the last SARS presentation, they mentioned that this document states that 3 days are required or suggested. We've searched this document. There are no 3 days specified, and we cannot understand why customs clearance must be tendered 3 days prior to the arrival of the vessel, when in fact this whole document is predicated on advanced customs declaration. And in the time limit specified in here for containerized cargo, it talks about risk analysis prior to loading of the container. The important paragraphs from SAFE can be found in 1.3.3, and it clearly specifies the two declarations that can be done. In terms of SARS slide 39, as mentioned, the 3 days are not to be found anywhere. Then GMNS was currently involved in delivery of customs training at 3 universities. We are an International Chamber of Commerce master trainer, a TITA trainer, a FIATA trainer, and a WCO accredited tutor. There are the certificates, and I've brought all the ICC instrument books here, where the ICC is an international acclaimed organization looking at breaking down the barriers to trade. What the report of SARS focused on was to only answer Incoterms. So therefore, in the last Incoterms, the provision for new Incoterms, D8T and D8P, were provided, which support that ICC is looking at facilitating inland deliveries. Professor Rambach was quoted, and GMLS ourselves brought out Professor Rambach to South Africa. The focus was mainly on CIF transactions, and this advocates that clearances will take place in Durban. This is our opinion as trainers, and we would clearly confirm to you that people that cannot deliver past the border post for fear of it being terminated will certainly be consulted with and requested to deliver to Durban. The ICC Incoterms, however, took account of customs in terms of the safe framework of standards and this accent on risk. What it did in its mirror rules, in rules A2, B2, A10 and B10, if customs utilize the Incoterms correctly, this is where they can get their advance electronic information from. They did not view this as it was inserted by Professor Rambach in the guide to Incoterms. The mirror rules before you there, you can see A2 and A10, and the advanced assistance in A10 and B10 is what is available through customs to be able to receive from exporters and carriers for security purposes. Then there are other carriers, not just people who own vessels. There is the groupage carriers. They account for thousands of consignments grouped together in what we call consolidations. These carriers were interviewed by us. If there is one consignee in a groupage consolidation of 10, for example, if one of them are not compliant, the rest will remain in Durban. So our concern is that this legislation, removing Section 18 and its current provisions, will allow for the fact that people who are not compliant are going to create congestion in the port and not those that are compliant. SARS have gone on record to say that 66% of clearances are pre-cleared anyway. What about those that are not? Are they not going to clog up the ports? I've got 2 pages here from the groupage carriers giving points of job losses, risks, unpacking, fraud, etc., etc., that will now infiltrate the groupage consignment industry. Furthermore, on bills of lading, clause 5.3, it clearly states that where a shipment is interrupted by any customs interference or intervention, that at that point the voyage will be deemed to have been lawfully concluded and the delivery of the goods by the carrier to customs will result in the termination. So, unfortunately, we have not had the opportunity to consult and give our views to SARS in terms of a research, and we believe that they should be looking at other solutions. The solutions in terms of the revised Toyota are declare earlier, declare at the point of departure. It says so here. It's written by the WCO, not by me. The ISP code, S code, the ISO codes, the SEAL verifications, the AEO programs, all of these provide for the advanced customs clearance for risk management purposes. I don't want a SARS that's going to look at a bomb in a container 3 days before the arrives at Durban. That is not the SARS I'm looking for. In terms of customs declarations and accountability for harmonized system, valuation, origin, those are called for in the advanced declaration, and SARS can achieve them. So I say, I believe that SARS has come to some agreements with some of the parties to facilitate and look at possibly negating the consequences of removal of Section 18. My request is, and suggestion is, either accept it, but review Section 18 removal very, very carefully, and ensure that when the rules are incorporated, that SARS reflect how it's done in terms of these instruments, because it's on these instruments that they predicate their new legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. Honorable members, we have had three presentations. The time for us to interact with the three submissions is now. And I'll try to be as time efficient as possible. And with your assistance, I think we'll be able to achieve that goal. Comments, questions? First question in the committee. Silence means consent. Okay. All right. Honorable Judith Chabalala, followed by Honorable Harris, Honorable David Ross, you'll follow. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. let me congratulate myself to being the first question in 2014 Finance Committee. But also let me greet everybody in the house. Chair, I'm going to just quickly go to SAOGA, the South African Oil Gas Alliance. I think my question to them will be that the issue of mechanism, where is it? The oil? Okay, sorry about that. Okay. I think, Chairperson, the first thing, it will be probably even practical for us to also have an oversight, to do an oversight of finance. Unfortunately, the issue is the time, but I think it might also serve a good purpose for us to look into that, so that we see the practicality of all this exercise that we're involved in. But I just want to find out, my question is simple, the issue, are you happy with the legislation in the current form? Is it your issue, only the issue will be the issue of the timeline that you're concerned about? Because that is something that I picked up when you speak about the issue of the timeline that SARS is proposing, the 3 years and the 2 years. But other than that, as far as the bill is concerned, are you comfortable with it? That's an easy question. Then let me go to the next presentation, the chartered accountants. I want to find out, I was quite intrigued with the gunshot approach. I also was thinking to myself, what does this really mean? Perhaps you can share with me outside the meeting. The issue of mechanisms, we're speaking about mechanisms that is unacceptable. However, the issue of the three-year detail update that the SARS is speaking about, do you have a problem with the reapplying, or do you have the problem around administration? You feel that SARS will not be able to do the issue of administration. Is it as simple as that? And my question is that, I mean, in any things that we see till to date, you need to update the information. Is it really too much of a strain if SARS were in the mechanism that they apply, to be, if they were to be sophisticated, depending on the method that they utilize, as far as the time is concerned, the issue of electronics that they're going to utilize rather than doing the manual issue, I think that you are concerned about. But that is my question. But as the chartered accountants, I'm quite intrigued. I would want to find out, as much as you show quite patience in the issue, how is it really affecting yourself as chartered accountant, the issue of the bill that you're dealing with, if you can share with me. The GMLS, the Cato protocol that you speak about, I think I want to appreciate the whole research. It's quite intense, it's quite detailed. One did go through it, it's quite huge. But of course you can get lost, can be confused easily when you follow it. But just to make it simple, I want to find out from you where you at, that look, the issue is that acceptance of the inland port that you would want SARS to add, would that make you feel comfortable as well, if they were to consider that? Yeah, I think, Chairperson, that's more like, that's over and above what I have. Thank you so much.
Honourable Tim, just know those questions. Honourable Tim.
Thanks, Chair. I think, in general, if I can just urge the presenters to go quite slowly with the committee. This committee is used to dealing with technical tax bills, because we do it every year. But this is an incredibly technical aspect of a aspect of South Africa's economy that none of us have probably ever dealt with. And there's a lot of terms that trip off your tongues that we actually are not au fait with. In general, some of the presentations were a little bit simpler to understand. Some of them, frankly, I was lost at various points. Now, I think you probably want us to understand. So if I can just urge you, when you start talking about the more detailed processes of your business, you're dealing with people who don't know these terms very well. But nevertheless, it is our responsibility to legislate here, so we are working to try and get our heads around it. The fact that we are sitting here today, I think, is testament to the submissions we had at the end of last year, where people said they needed more time, they needed a longer period to get to terms with the new version of the bill. I think the parliamentary process was extended to allow that. So you can see that as a victory. It's certainly something which I think most of the members in the committee supported. But now, for me, given that the biggest issue is the status of the inland port, we should really spend a lot of time today looking at the options that SARS put on the table, I believe, on the 5th of November, where they proposed two different options to try and solve the issue. Now, one of the things I'm interested in from the presenters who presented already is what you think of those two options. Would either of them work, and if is one preferable to the other? And indeed, from the presenters who are coming later, I would also like that perspective, because we have, I think, in the spirit of engagement from SARS, been given these two options. Now, it's up to the committee to consider them, but we need to know from the perspective of the insiders, of you, of the industry, whether these are possible solutions or whether we need to look at a third option, perhaps. I'm sure everybody has these two proposals from SARS, but in essence, the first one suggests that a customs clearance, in line with that standards to secure and facilitate global trade framework, that a customs clearance is submitted 3 days in advance of arrival at a port of entry. And the second option, as I understand it, is that we create a separate type of document where the required information, as well as details around the importer, is reflected on that document. Not a full clearance certificate, but another type of document. And if I've misunderstood SARS's two options there, if someone could explain them to me, but they appear to be some way towards, each of them appears to be some way towards a different solution to the major problem. So personally, that's the one issue that I would like some more detail on from everyone, if you have a perspective. On the specific presentations we got, for Saike, can you, your general concern was that you haven't seen the regulations and the legislation works or doesn't work on the basis of what's in the regulations. I mean, this is a it's an old story in Parliament, the tension between what we put into the regulations and what we put into subordinate, or rather into the legislation and into subordinate legislation. And in general, my view and our view as a party is that we need to put as much as possible into the legislation, because it puts those issues, or it makes those issues subject to parliamentary oversight. We're essentially hands-off when it comes to regulations. But of course, we understand that your legislation needs to be simple, clear, and easy to understand, and often there are things that it's simply not appropriate to include in legislation. But one possible solution to what Saike was asking for, I mean, personally, it would be great if you had sight of the regulations, but I don't think that there's necessarily an obligation to show you those before we pass the legislation. But what is a more fundamental point is whether there should be issues that are currently kicked into the regulations that we should, as a committee, be putting into the legislation. So if you can tell us if there's anything like that, we will certainly, from our side, we will certainly be considering changing the legislation to include some of those issues, because I personally am more comfortable with critical issues lying in the legislation rather than the regulations. Then there were two issues that Saike brought up around the registration process. I'm interested in the international precedent for registration. This requirement for registration every 3 years, is that unique? Do other countries do it? How out of step are we, if you don't like that idea? And then in the customs duty bill, you talk about the duty reassessment. I just need you to go through that again for me. What exactly, in simple terms, does that mean? What is the process that followed? And in particular, how will the proposed change the existing mechanism of duty reassessment? Then the last presentation, GMLS, I found it difficult to follow, but at one point you actually quote this SAFE framework of standards, wherever the presenter is now, there we go, which is the exact quote that SARS uses in their option number one, I think. Yeah, I mean, does that mean that you're in support of this option that SARS has proposed as option one? Have you seem to be echoing the same requirement that customs clearance is submitted 3 days in advance of arrival. But if you don't agree with that option, can you just tell us specifically why and what you would prefer as an alternative? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I fully agree with Tim that we should have a slow go approach in terms of assessing what's happening here, because if we have a presentation from GMLS indicating that trade is spells apart from SARS, I think we need more consultation perhaps on certain aspects with regards to that statement. I agree the main concerns is the issue of the inland ports. It's a thorny issue. Business is very concerned with regards to that. And only, I believe, the unions are taking the other view with regards to scrapping of the inland ports. And then the alternative options provided by SARS, the advance clearance and the different types of documents, I hope that there is sufficient consultation with SARS, with all the parties involved. And then I believe we need another legal opinion with in terms of the importer, the implications of the importer in the involvement before clearance. I think we need to consult with legal experts on that one. And of course, any alternative suggestions managing risk and custom frauds would be welcome. Specific presentations from oil and gas, I share your concerns in terms of Section 19, concerns with regards to the timeframes. It's a valid concern. And then also SAICA, the lack of rules and regulations that you've indicated. I think Tim has dealt with that extensively. But the concern here is the lack of the input from the Department of Finance, as indicated. I believe there should be more consultation, more definite proposals also to this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And I would like to... Thank you, Chair. And I would like to greet everybody and say compliments to all. And thank you for the presentation, for your time. That you have actually to compile all this and come back. Now, Chair, although I came late, but what I don't get from the presenter, the one that the SAICA and the GMLS, I remember when we were to come back and have this hearings, the last time was that there was not enough consultation. They were not given enough time to go through what was being proposed in the bill, and I don't get the answer either from what I've just heard thus far. Now, I just want to go to GMLS. They are saying the research, and unfortunately there was no consultation with SARS. Now, I want to get a better understanding here. Consultation, does it mean, what is the meaning of consultation? Does it mean you still don't have enough time to engage with what is being proposed in the bill? Or does this mean that the SARS did not take what you have presented, or the SARS decided not to engage with yourselves on your proposal? Because I need to understand that as a legislator, what exactly do you mean by consultation? Because if SARS is not consulting efficiently, but we need to measure as to what criteria, what exactly are you saying as the company in regards to that? And also, you have also said, declare sooner. What is sooner? What is sooner? How do you measure sooner? Is it 2 seconds? Is it a second? Is it a day? Exactly what do you mean? And lastly, Chair, still on them, you question quite a number of monitoring instruments, international instruments here. Now, the way you have put them, it's like SARS never adhered to them. Is this my right understanding? Is exactly what you've put on your page on the way, on when you're talking about the solutions? Is this what you're saying to us? You're saying, SARS, there are these international instruments that are put in, but when you were compiling your recommendations or amending your bill, we did not take in consideration of this. Is this right? Is it my understanding? Thank you, Chair.
You would respond in the order that you made the presentations. Just bear in mind time constraints. Fire.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. Okay, so the first questioner wants to know whether the SOGA presentation and concerns were concerned with the 3-day timeline from time of import, or whether we were more concerned with the legislation. I can say that our concern really is with the legislation. If one looks at Chapter 12, at the temporary admission procedures, which SARS has incorporated in the Customs Control Bill, which I think are reflected in the specific annexes to the revised Kyoto Convention to which SARS now acceded, then we find therein that there's no reference there to an to automation of or there's no procedure described in chapter 12 that I could see. Which says basically that if you submit a temporary admission application to SARS, that your SAT 500, your customs declaration to SARS, will be the application. So there are two possible amendments which could be introduced in the customs control bill. The first one would be in chapter 12, which would basically be an automation of the temporary admission procedure, which basically would involve the insertion of a clause under Chapter 12, which basically makes clear that the submission of your temporary import customs declaration is basically your application for temporary admission. The alternative, if SARS cannot automate the process, is basically the SAOGA proposal, which we put forward formally in the first document, which I mentioned to you, which is the which is basically the comment sheet. Okay, so that's the alternative, which basically caters for a manual process and then basically extends the customs declaration process. Okay, so that's the first question. And the second question is from the Honourable Tim Harris concerning the presenter's view on the inland ports issue between SARS and trade. And I remember I was here on 5 November, and SARS made two proposals. And the one was maybe create another document which would require population of certain additional info fields, which would enable SARS to do a better risk assessment and decide whether to stop the shipment or not. And the other one, I understand, is advanced clearance. Is that correct? Yes. Now, that's 3 days before arrival of the shipment at port. The advanced clearance procedure would basically, I think, entail, and I speak under correction, I didn't have a personal discussion with SARS, would still entail a customs declaration in the prescribed form, being a national transit bill of entry. That's my understanding. I mean, I see that SARS is shaking their heads. Okay, so I don't understand that process. SARS National had a discussion with SARS about it, and they came to a certain agreement about something, so I can't really comment about that. But I must say that my own background is very strongly in customs. I worked for customs for 16 years, with the very people who sit there, in fact, was a SARS head office for 4 years as a customs specialist. So I'm not a shipping expert, but what I can say is that the Cape Chamber of Commerce, we took the International Chamber of Commerce, Pat Corbin, who's here today as well, came down from Johannesburg and did a presentation to the Cape Chamber of Commerce about the inland ports. That certainly caused alarm bells to go off for me, and I'm certainly very concerned with the fact that SARS wants to basically remove the status of City Deep as an inland port. I should also add that in terms of the current customs legislation, now we just say that it is an inland port, nor is there any provision therein which says even that City Deep is a place of entry. So since the mid-70s, City Deep has always been There's always been a concession from SARS, basically, which gives Seredeep the status of an inland port without actually saying that Seredeep is an inland port. And that is very clear from Section 18 of the current customs legislation, which says that the movement of the container from the port of Durban to Seredeep can take place under cover of the manifest in the container. And the shipping line is basically in charge of that movement. So the ship stops in Seredeep. So from my side, it certainly is a concern, and I sympathize with the Chamber of Commerce presentation.
Thank you.
And
can you summarize?
Yes. Okay, then just one other thing that Saika mentioned, which I think ties in very much with this whole business, is also that a concern of mine from the start, and I agree with Saika, is that the current legislation which is to be promulgated is not supported at all by any supporting customs rules. And that certainly is a big concern, because there's a lot of stuff we're not seeing. We can't see, or there's a lot of unknowns here, which is going to be formulated in the rules, which we haven't seen yet. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you. I'll just maybe start up front with that thorny issue of Seredeep and understand why it's quite emotive. I'm not going to elaborate on it, because I think a lot of independent members that form part of our committee have dealt through it in other forums, whether it be representing other organizations such as BUSA and similar, and through the NetLAC process. We'll just leave that aside from our side at the moment. I think a lot has been said on it, and gosh, I think take a breather just over that. But anyway, let's move on. The reference to a gunshot, while it might seem unnecessarily aggressive, I think the intention here is that if you use something which has a very broad exposure to, which is, I guess, in the description of the word, to do as much damage as possible, or perhaps to be as effective as possible, you know, you don't need to necessarily use something broad when you have a specific tool such as a pin or a knife. SARS has been driven by modernization, and the tools we are told they'll be using are intelligent risk modeling, as well as other improved electronic systems. My feeling is that whether the systems are manual or electronic is not important as whether or not they are soundly structured. Electronic is just, it's capturing mechanism and perhaps time efficiency. But at the end of the day, we don't need to go and blanket everything when we are told that there's impressive algorithms and logical processes that are being formalized to allow the controller to very specifically go and identify risk. That's why you don't have to require absolutely everyone to redo it every couple of years. The onus is on the client, and it would always remain on the client. Currently, there's an incredible amount of leverage on the client. And I'll tell you why. Because I believe in the number of consultations and assistance we've yielded to clients, a huge chunk, if not 80% or more, of the problems somebody encounters starts with the very basic building block, which is their registration. If you change your activity and you don't understand what you're doing, you're going to land up with a problem. You have to know what you're doing. You must go and make sure you're compliant, and you do not need an electronic system to remind you every 3 years, or to have your lifeline cut off, or your activity cut off. SARS currently can leverage clients, and they're telling us that they can do it even better and control it better with the system that they'll be rolling out. There's no need to go and have this blanket cover. It serves no purpose. It's inefficient. It will drain SARS resources. It will irritate everybody, including SARS officers, and it will take up precious time and create a problem for trade facilitation. Clear. When it comes to the...
through fight.
Yeah. When it comes to the rules, I think you guys, as you mentioned, as legislators, you're sitting with the same dilemma we've got. Of course, it would be wonderful if everything was put into the bills, because you're quite right. It has to go through one additional check to be changed. Currently, the commissioner can implement rules and regulations at will, and sometimes very short notice and without much a pushback. I think the new bills are quite voluminous. We are sitting here, as you pointed out, with a discipline that is incredibly obscure, and our Act of 1964, while many of us have become quite comfortable with it, is the zone of discomfort that we sit in, because it really is a spaghetti. Those who know it well, they know how to navigate it, but the intention is always to make it easier to navigate and work with. That's fine. The new bills are quite voluminous. There's a lot of detail in there that perhaps wasn't there. It was not as transparent. I enjoy reading them, although it takes some time to go through them again and again. But ultimately, that is what we'll be working with in future. It, I suppose, would be great if we could put more of the detail, the rules into there. But this is the question. Where is the balancing act? And we're not even saying at the moment where some of the provisions need to sit. We just want to make sure that whatever we've looked at and whatever we applied our mind to in assisting the other stakeholders to come to this final piece of legislation is a holistic view. Because we don't know what's in the rules, we can only imagine. If we haven't seen them, we can't say if they need to be in the Act. Because at the moment, we're just dealing with one plethora of elements. So, I know we keep on harping on it, but at the end of the day, when is it going to come out anyway? When the bills are enacted, the next day they're going to pop out, and then we're going to say, gosh, come on guys, we've got another interesting piece of documentation to read through, and by the way, there's already problems starting at the border. We're all going to be running around trying to drive and to stabilize it. Let's just see it.
Okay.
And then finally, the input from the Department of Finance, we also tried to interact with them directly. We had a number of meetings set up. All those were cancelled. While I understand that the controller has a detailed view into the bills, it would be good to know that the department is driving them also to understand their view on it. But we never had that opportunity. International cases. Look, jurisdictions vary, but generally from the jurisdictions that I've worked with and colleagues overseas and such, there are no time limits imposed on registration. Some jurisdictions refer to them as licenses. I don't want to get into the jargon because in our jurisdiction it means a very different thing. But the general understanding is that you must engage with the revenue authority and let them know what your intention is. That's fundamental. I think that addressed most of the questions that were asked.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, do you have anything to add?
Yes, please. I would like to respond to the questions that were raised and directed to us. Firstly, from the first lady that had addressed us, she wanted to know whether we accept the inland port and what is our concern with the inland port. In terms of the new academic subjects of FIATA, there is a clear accent on inland ports and places where customs activities will take place, such as inspections and receipt of cargo and places to which you can consign cargo to. We also regard a port as a place internationally that you can regard as a destination, which will not be subject to any type of interruption, provided you've conducted your risk assessments in advance as guided by the WCO. The reason that I make that statement is that when the WCO introduced the SAFE framework and revised Kyoto, it actually understood that these type of security compliances could destroy trade facilitation, and then it went at length to ensure that it built in the mechanisms for trade facilitation to take place. So we are not fearful of the word port or terminal or whatever you want to call it. It simply does indicate to our overseas trading partners that they have a place of destination to deliver into. Then our second questions were regarding the complexity and simplicity. We apologize, it is a hugely complex subject. WCO instruments and conventions for a non-governmental international organization charged now since 9/11 with this global supply chain security represents something like over 25 different conventions, all advocating some or other type of international cooperation. So we apologize for that, and perhaps where the suggestion was made for a legal opinion on the importer, I would suggest that we do that on Incoterms to understand why new Incoterms were introduced and what they represented in terms of trade. In terms of consultation, the question from the fourth speaker was that, unfortunately, we did request SARS to participate in the research. We provided them with the terms of reference. We arrived at SARS and we were told that they were not interested in any meetings and that their point was known. After that, after providing the research, we again wrote to SARS twice, only then to find out that SARS had gone a different direction to get another opinion, and then to present that opinion to this committee. Yet the opinion was presented on Incoterms, which we and my colleague next to me, Mr. Corbyn, we are the ICC.
So, Richard, I think Mr. Umak is quite... What is Incoterms?
Incoterms. Okay, may I please...
I just indicate that all of you have made verbal and written submissions.
Oh.
Correct.
That information that is in the document, let's not repeat it because of time.
Sure. But for short clarification, for that's a good question. In any international buy and sell transaction, there's always the subject of delivery between a buyer and a seller. Incoterms determines that exact responsibility, the place where risks, costs, and responsibilities transfer, the default point. We are saying, if you interfere before that point with a customs intervention, which was provided for because Incoterms is updated every 10 years, it has been, to keep abreast of trade patterns. And when Professor Rambach visited South Africa in 2010, because he was quoted in the SARS opinion, we gave him the details of the new safe regime of the WCO. And he provided for it. And it is in the Incoterms opinion. And we believe that if SARS rather use those suggestions, then it can take care of this concern. And we believe that the balance between a risk declaration versus a fiscus declaration can be understood and sorted out so that at the end of the day, trade facilitation takes place. I've about wrapped it, if I can.
No, that's fine. I think so far, so good.
Thank you.
Honourable members, I think we have run over by 15 minutes, which has taken our tea time, but I won't be that cruel in our first meeting. Can we have 7 minutes break and come back? Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you presented and the courses that you've given us. Thank you.